You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
With this, we mark the halfway point of Daniel's disremembered saga and John and my own confusion at this whole whatever. So I hope you keep listening, keep enjoying. Well, as mentioned in... well, you'll see, but there's going to be at least one more surprise this month, kind of a holiday present, if you will. We've entered the Muppet Movie Month, and consider that appropriate. I hope you guys are enjoying this holiday season. Hope you're getting a little relaxation done. I know it's not always a relaxing time of year, so please enjoy. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to Disremembered, the stories behind your childhood. This season, we're discussing the Disney Renaissance and its lasting impacts on the entertainment industry. I'm Daniel. I am the host of Disremembered, frequent contributor to Myopia Defend Your Childhood, Mission Briefing, and also columnist on Pop Dose. And with me on panel, we have...
Hi, I'm Nick Hoffman, host of Myopia Defend Your Childhood and Riff Ron Cineprov.
And I'm John, the new host of Mission Briefing, Bond Podcast.
Did you think my introduction was going to go on a little longer there, John?
I did, actually. It normally goes on for quite a while.
Father, husband, jean wearer, belt owner.
Be careful or else the dollop will sue us.
I don't think they have the energy.
Well, that's probably true.
I don't know. They put out two things a week. They must have some energy.
Well, they're down to one a week.
Oh, are they?
Yeah. So, on the last episode, we talked about Michael Eisner joining the Disney Studios as its head and Jeffrey Katzenberg joining as the head of the film division. And I promise I am able to talk, so hopefully all the mispronunciations will stop. And this episode... we're going to get into some of their biggest successes of the era. Now, if you'll recall, we left off the last time talking about two animated films which didn't really do all that well for Disney. First, there was The Black Cauldron. Then there was The Great Mouse Detective. Then there was Oliver and Company. But I told you that they would have a very nice turnaround with one film in particular. That film was Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Oh, yeah. That's a good movie. I love that movie.
I assume everybody on planet Earth by this point has seen it.
Yeah, it's a classic, man. It's a great
Aren't
show.
They making a sequel of that?
They've been talking about that really since the first one came out, but I don't think it's ever actually going to happen.
Just the rights alone must be a nightmare to get.
Well, they released some shorts, and I remember seeing a couple of the short films after the movie was released because they put cartoons in front of other Disney movies, but it took like 3 or 4 years for those to come out.
Yeah, it was mostly in the late 90s, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I'm also trying to think as well, like, I don't know, it reminds me a lot of Wreck-It Ralph as well, which is, of course, more recent, but they were able to get a bunch of rights for video game companies, but it was through a third party. And that kind of seems like how it's going to have to be, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just making it originally was a nightmare to do because of all the rights. And, I mean, watching some of the scenes now, especially when it's a Disney and Warner Brothers character sharing the screen, it's like, how many lawyers were in the room with the script writers?
I know there was a writer that every Warner Brothers character had to be on screen for the same amount of time as a Disney character.
Right.
And that really pigeonholed the writers. And so everybody is generally in duets. So like the Donald Duck and Daffy Duck scene, it is a perfect example where they're both on stage, on screen at the same time. And you do cut to one, cut to the other, cut to the other, cut to both.
Well, and like, or the scene where Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse are like falling through the scene And so, if I recall correctly, Bugs Bunny has to enter the scene first. Mickey Mouse has to be on screen last. And, like, they have to have the same amount of lines, and they have to each deliver a joke. And, like, it's not funny.
Yeah.
And considering how good the movie is, the writers really did a good job.
Yeah.
Well, it was a culmination of a bunch of people, and it took a while for them to get it to screen. As I'm sure you may have heard, it was based on a book, but the book is way different from the movie that ended up on screen. So let's get into the making of Roger Rabbit. The director was Bob Zemeckis, who had already done the first Back to the Future and was considered a very big name in Hollywood. He had been asked to do it along with other directors, including Terry Gilliam was at one point considered to direct Who Framed Roger Rabbit. But Robert Zemeckis didn't want to do it because he hated Michael Eisner. Eisner had previously said that he didn't think Zemeckis was talented.
That's a common theme, though, isn't it? A lot of people hated Eisner.
Yep, it's a very common theme. But Steven Spielberg, who was producing or executive producing Roger Rabbit, eventually relented and said, okay, please direct our movie. And Zemeckis eventually was like, all right, I'll do it. But Zemeckis also had some problems with the current Disney staff. He didn't trust the Disney animators because he didn't like their last two films. So he set up his own animation studio and hired Richard Williams to direct the animation. Now, some of you guys probably remember that name. He was a British animator who did the Pink Panther movie openings.
That's why it doesn't look like normal Disney animation.
Exactly.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because, he essentially went somewhere that isn't competitive either. That must have been quite a trick to find. Because, like, obviously by this point, what's his name? He did Land Before Time. Goddamn, my brain went completely blank. Hi.
Lucas?
No. Land Before Time. And he did An American Tale.
Oh, Don Bluth?
Yeah, because Don Bluth was clearly active. But you're not going to ask Don Bluth because Disney would definitely pull out then. Same with Warner Brothers. So you have to find someone who's small enough that it's not going to intervene with either of them. But they're not going to find... Like, that's quite a trick he pulled off, actually.
Yeah, they have to be big enough then to do the job.
No. That's funny.
So, the movie was in production, and the principal photography went along very well. But Katzenberg was very upset with the progress. It wasn't getting done on time, and Richard Williams was well known for being a huge perfectionist. For example, you've probably heard of The Thief and the Cobbler. That was a movie that Richard Williams had been trying to make for about 30 or so years by that point because he insisted on drawing every frame by hand.
Wow.
And eventually that was a separate story. He got taken away from him and was released in a severely condensed form and just turned out terribly. But either way, Williams took a while to do his animation, and it pissed off Katzenberg. But the animators working for Williams also hated Disney's conditions. They felt Disney turned the animation process into a conveyor belt, and Disney even had a computer program that calculated the animators' productivity, which they were not fans of.
Wow. Oh, shit.
Yeah, so it's like the modern times version of animation.
That's crazy.
Sounds horrible.
The reason Disney was so time-conscious, though, was because they already had promotional tie-ins with McDonald's to release merchandise for the film, and they really already had a firm deadline to get the movie in theaters. Still...
That's so stupid.
Still, they had a little bit of fun at Michael Eisner's expense. You probably remember that one of Eisner's rivals at Paramount was Joel Silver, the guy who ended up producing all the action franchises like Die Hard and Lethal Weapon and The Matrix.
Mm-hmm.
In order to mess with Eisner, they cast Joel Silver in Roger Rabbit as the director at the beginning who is complaining about Roger blowing his lines by seeing birds instead of stars.
That's really
funny.
Yeah, that was Joel Silver.
Oh, that's funny.
Wow. Just to spite Disney?
Just to spite Michael Eisner, and basically...
And he's okay with that?
Michael Eisner's reaction, at first he didn't recognize Joel Silver, but eventually when he found out, the only thing he said was, well, he did a good job.
I have a feeling that Eisner doesn't care unless it's making money, right? And so if it starts losing money, I'm sure they would have heard about it. But since it was fine, he grinned and bared it because he's still winning. The guy's still working for him, right? At this point, we're reaching, like, pure ego.
Well, it boils down to a formula, doesn't it? Like, they know how to make money, and they don't really care as long as they do make money. I mean, like Daniel said, they were more concerned about the product placement and the Disney or the McDonald's release than they were about the actual movie.
Yeah.
Well, the problem with this, though, is they were very worried that the movie wouldn't be successful, and that was reinforced during the first Roger Rabbit test screening. It was a disaster.
Really?
Katzenberg thought that he would get fired based on that screening. The audience had been told that they were seeing a new Rambo movie, so they were expecting, you know, Sylvester Stallone violence, and instead got a cartoon rabbit. Wow. And the animation wasn't finished in time for the screening, and to top it off, the film broke halfway through.
This is like that Wolverine screening where it's just none of the effects were in, so they were just flailing at each other wearing green pants or whatever it was, so that like... That's pretty atrocious for a special effects movie.
Wasn't that the final cut for the Wolverine?
Yeah, well, might as well have been. It couldn't have been any better or worse, so.
Mm-hmm.
Well.
So, wait, let me get this right. That for a test screening of Roger Rabbit, which is a cartoon, which is slapstick, they tell the test audience, you're going to see the most violent, messed up movie ever about Vietnam.
Yes.
Well, this was Rambo, would have been Rambo 3, correct? Because
yes,
Rambo 2 was
point.
In the 70s, or in the early 80s. So this would have been a follow-up to what was the bloodiest and most violent movie ever made. And it's a slapstick comedy starring Mario. Mario, if I recall correctly.
Yeah. There's no way the audience would feel betrayed about that.
Yeah, no. Nah. I don't understand the story, Daniel. It's almost like it wasn't worth mentioning.
What, the story of a test screening going bad?
Well, in Hollywood, yeah. I mean, I've seen The Room. It always turns out for the best.
All right, point taken. So Disney was convinced they had another disaster on their hands at this point, but in the end, it all paid off. A few of the more optimistic people were really hoping that Roger Rabbit would be the highest-grossing film of 1988. They were sadly wrong. It was the second highest-grossing movie of 1988.
What was number one?
I'm glad you asked. The answer is Rain Man.
No shit.
Really?
Yes.
That's a fine movie, but it's surprising for a top feature. Did Spielberg have nothing to do that summer?
He was working on Roger Rabbit, producing it, so...
Ah, man. That's a real shame.
More importantly, though, for the Renaissance, Roger Rabbit reignited an interest in Golden Age animation. I'm sure everybody remembers what 80s cartoons were like, and those characters like Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse had been kind of just considered more corporate mascots than actual interesting dynamic characters. Roger Rabbit changed that. On the other hand, Katzenberg was becoming increasingly interested in making animated movies with Disney. Originally, if you'll recall, he'd been on the fence with it because nothing he was doing was successful, and he didn't really know what he was doing, but Roger Rabbit changed that. So, hooray? No, not hooray. I'm sure everybody, and I know you do, John, considering your history, remembers Disney's next big animated film after that, which was The Little Mermaid.
Woohoo! That was the next one, really?
Right after Roger Rabbit, yeah.
Wow.
88. So the they
knocked it out of the park with that one.
Well, that's the reentering of the Gilded Era, right? Like this is the yeah, at their height.
This one they followed it up with Aladdin and Lion King and all those ones that, like, the Oscar-worthy Disney movies.
Exactly. So there was definitely some more big interest in there. But strangely enough, in Kim Masters' book, The Little Mermaid only gets 2 pages, which confused me considering how big it actually was. So I had to do a bit more digging to find out some more interesting facts about it. Still, shout out to Kim Masters for writing Keys to the Kingdom. It's been a primary resource that I've been using in compiling this. Go check it out if you can. One interesting thing that Masters mentioned, though, considering how Disney was paying attention to merchandise, was originally Disney screwed up the Little Mermaid merchandise. All the Ariel dolls were strawberry blonde because no one thought a redheaded doll would sell.
That's funny.
Wow.
What?
Well, I guess the only other redheaded character would be something like Little Orphan Annie, right?
Pretty much.
Huh.
Wasn't one of those Barbie sisters like blonde or redhead, like Skipper or Stumpet or? Oh yeah, Strumpet. That's right.
Yeah,
Strumpet
yeah,
the Barbie.
The Barbie Strumpet. Yeah, that's funny.
That sounds just like what Jerry Falwell would call Barbie dolls if he ever was in a toy store.
That's funny.
That's why he's not allowed in toy stores
anymore. That's exactly right.
There are several reasons.
Yeah.
So as a little bit more background, Disney had considered making a film based on the Little Mermaid story back in the 30s. It had gone into hibernation as they went on to other things, and it was repitched in the 80s. At first, Katzenberg rejected it because he was too concerned it would be like the Splash sequel Disney was trying to make at the time.
Slash?
Splash is the guitarist for Guns N' Roses. The movie Splash was the movie with Tom
Splash.
Hanks and Daryl
oh, I
Hannah.
Splash.
Yes.
I thought you were saying Slash. Oh, that makes more sense. Yeah.
But eventually the Splash sequel went back into development hell and they put The Little Mermaid back in development. This was also the first time that Disney started hiring outside songwriters from Broadway. In this case, they hired Alan Menken to do the songs. At the time, he was most famous for writing the Little Shop of Horrors musical.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
Weird choice for Disney.
So obviously we should put him in charge of a child's movie.
Exactly. They also tried to make the figures look a little more grounded in reality. For example, Ariel's body type and personality were primarily based on Alyssa Milano.
Wait, what?
Oh, that tickled me.
I'm about to do you one better, Nick. Ursula, the villain, was based on Divine.
No way.
Yes.
The famous drag queen.
Correct.
That does make perfect sense. And Sebastian was based on Ziggy Marley?
Why not?
I didn't know Alyssa Milano hated that kind of, like relationship with the drag queen community. That's funny.
The more you know.
Yeah, right?
Now, in between the films, Disney was also becoming more ambitious in trying to acquire more intellectual property. One of the biggest things at the time was Disney trying to buy the rights to the Muppets. It was meant to be a huge coup for Disney, but it ended with disaster because Jim Henson very suddenly died halfway through the deal. They realized that they didn't have all of the rights. Disney realized that they didn't have all the rights they expected because Henson had already licensed some of them out to other places, and his children ended up realizing they wouldn't make as much money as they expected. They ended up suing Disney because most of the contracts had been verbal agreements.
They sued Disney because Disney pulled out?
They sued Disney because the negotiations weren't completed and the kids realized that the deal wasn't worth as much as Disney had originally claimed it was.
And I would imagine Jim Henson dying, his will would dictate who's in charge of the estate, and he may have characters going off in all sorts of different.
Well, plus his characters already were owned by different people. Like, for example, all the Sesame Street characters were owned by one company. Some of the other characters were owned by somebody else.
Well, and it's also worth mentioning here that this is the worst thing to ever happen ever. Because they were going to make at MGM Studios an entire Muppets land, including
and this really bummed me out when I learned about this, including a place called Pizza Rizzo, where animatronic rats would bring out your pizzas, so it looked like Rizzo. There was supposed to be, like, a food science slash restaurant owned by the Swedish chef, and because of all this crap, the only thing we end up with is that Muppets 3D ride, because, and they were going to cut that even, but it was literally the last thing Jim Henson directed before he died, and so that's a really easy argument to make. Are you really going to shelf the last thing Jim Henson directed? But, like, so much of MGM Studios, until at least recently, has been utter garbage. It would have been cool to have something like Muppets Land. Like, the Muppets are an interesting property, but it kind of is an interesting problem that you're bringing up, right? Because so much of what he is reviving the past. Like, and like, bringing back that classical animation, creating these new characters that kind of would belong to be in Disney's upper echelons, right? The Muppets are exactly what should have been there alongside Star Wars, but this whole, like, really gums up the works, man. It's really crazy.
Yeah, no, and eventually it ended with a very public humiliation for Disney, because after all, getting into a fight with Jim Henson's kids after Henson recently died, obviously that's bad PR. They eventually settled the lawsuit and had to issue a, quote, humiliating public apology.
Eisner has never apologized for anything ever. He probably ran over someone's kid once, and he was just like, you know what? My bumper is, like, damaged. It's your fault, kid.
Like that guy in A Tale of Two Cities who, after he ran over a kid, was like, do you know what that kid could have done to my horses?
Yeah, exactly right. That's exactly right. It's literature, see, John. It's okay.
We're classy here. We're referencing smart things. Please listen to us. We'll educate you.
Yeah, no, we've done two cardinal myopia sins. We've not only mentioned better movies, but better books and better podcasts. So we're up Schitt's Creek at the moment.
At the time, Disney was also growing increasingly protective of its property. This was the time where they threatened a local Florida daycare with a lawsuit for having Disney characters painted on their wall.
Oh, I remember hearing about this.
Yeah.
It's 100% true.
Oh, that's so funny. What dipshits.
Yeah, really. Let's go after the daycare full of innocent children.
Well, let's go after your biggest fans.
Yeah, really.
Right? Like, I understand suing people who are, like, bootlegging movies or making money off those characters, but you're talking about, like, a daycare, right? Like, that's so funny.
I seem to recall reading something earlier this week as a recording where Disney is threatening a lawsuit against a company that hires out people dressed as Marvel characters.
Yes, for birthdays.
For birthdays, right.
Oh, my God.
Well, Disney also fought with some other big media conglomerates at the time, including Rupert Murdoch. In 1988, Disney worked with Murdoch to launch a satellite TV channel in Europe, but Disney never ponied up their side of the money for the joint venture.
Wow, what a dick move.
Yeah, oh, it's ripping off Rupert Murdoch. I'm actually kind of torn on this one.
Yeah.
Well, it's going to get better because this whole litigious attitude ended up creating another important part of our childhood.
Bankruptcy?
Disney later fought with Fox Channel affiliates over their afternoon cartoon blocks.
Oh, right!
Originally, all the Fox affiliates would air Disney programming in the afternoons for kids, you know, right after they get home from school, they'll watch TV. But they bought a local TV station in L.A. and said they wouldn't provide that cartoon package to that Fox affiliate because they wanted to use that block for their own TV channel. So Barry Diller, if you remember him, he was at Paramount with Eisner, who was running the Fox studio now, said he would drop Disney from all Fox stations and leave the programming empty. But this meant that Fox started having to create their own kiddie programming.
Oh, man.
So this is crazy. So what they came up with was buying this re-edited Japanese show and putting it on the afternoon for kids, and that's why Power Rangers exists.
My God. And as we're getting into the 90s, this is also why they bought up a whole bunch of shit, right? Like, this is where we get things like Sailor Moon, because we needed a demographic aim at girls. this is a popular show in Japan, we can just dub it, and it becomes, like, not only a huge deal, but, like, the first anime show dubbed into English aimed at women, which is crazy. Yeah. Like,
wow.
What a dude's move.
These would have been some of the first mainstream anime.
Yeah.
All because Fox dropped Disney over a spat. And I would think at this time, Fox would still be relatively new.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, it was like, still relatively new. It only came out in the mid-80s.
Yeah.
Well, and this is also, Megan, for lack of a better term, kind of topical for them as well, because remember, these shows in Japan are still fairly recent. You know, like when Hanna-Barbera did it and they bought up Speed Racer for, you know, those kind of blocks, it was already a very old show that they were dubbing even cheaper, right? Right. And so by the time it was on TBS and we were seeing it, it was a forgettable experience. This stuff is fairly recent. Like, that's crazy. I was impressed, Daniel. Good job. Well done. Point well made.
Hooray. Yeah.
So Disney is very good at creating its own competition, right?
Speaking of which, there was one other big purchase, which is especially relevant considering what's been all over the news today that Disney made during the time, and that was their purchase of Miramax.
With or without Harvey Weinstein?
Oh, this was totally with the Weinsteins at the time.
Yeah, the Weinsteins are kind of all Miramax was, and frankly, still kind of is. Because I think it just now his brother's in charge, right?
Well, they if I recall correctly, in the mid-2000s, they left Miramax to form their own company, which was just the Weinstein Company.
Well, right, but aren't they still partial shareholders? I mean, I could be wrong. Who knows? I'm trying to pay as little attention to this as possible because it's all very depressing.
Now, the Miramax story and how they influenced the 90s indie boom is worth a podcast/book/whatever all on its own, and luckily one such exists. It's called Down and Dirty Pictures by Peter Biskind. I've read it. Again, check it out if you ever get the time. It really just shows what a couple of asses the Weinsteins were even before we realized they were alleged criminals.
No, I think once you pay people off, you're no longer alleged anything. But I will say, as far as all that shenanigan goes, it's interesting, you know, I was going to use a really bad term. I was going to say incestuous, but how small that world is, isn't it? Like,
oh yeah.
Like as someone has pulled the string, how it's all unraveling. We're not going to get to Michael Eisner having sex ever, are we? Because that's going to make me very sad.
I mean, he already had a wife and children at this point. I mean, this is
that doesn't mean the story can't take a bizarre turn for like people dressing up like Minnie Mouse and going to spanking parties or something.
So far, no. I haven't encountered any of those stories.
That's for the next episode.
Yeah, right? Gorsh. Gorsh, Michael, I don't think we should be doing it. Seems like she's dying.
Oh. When they're dead, Goofy, they're just hookers.
They're not... They're not even people!
This child starlet is the property of the Walt Disney Corporation.
Well, gosh, Mickey. And you put it like that, Michael Eisner, come back over here. children.
So originally, Miramax was entirely Katzenberg's deal. Eisner was only convinced to go along with it after seeing the profit margins, which were huge, for The Crying Game.
All right.
It gets even better. The first big thing that Miramax produced after being acquired by Disney was none other than Pulp Fiction. But the acquisition of Miramax, despite getting Disney a lot of indie cred, also caused controversy, especially after Miramax started releasing NC-17 movies like Kids.
No shit. Oh, that's funny. Is it like, I mean, I guess now they deal mostly with Touchstone, right? But, like, the idea that these R-rated movies for Disney, they're trying to separate themselves from making money off, you know, because I think Miramax also produced Clerks, right?
They did.
Is also a masterpiece.
Which also almost got an NC-17 just based on the amount of swearing in the movie.
Well, and the original ending where, like, someone comes in and just shoots him, right?
Yeah.
like to rob the convenience store, which is on the DVD and is on the Criterion DVD, which is something. Well, that's for damn sure. Good contribution, John. Sorry, the wine is kicking in. I'm warming up.
That's what I'm here for.
Yeah. I'm here just
to make the occasional grunt and comment.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
I'm actually looking about the kids, and I've never actually seen that movie.
It's interesting.
I don't know if I want to.
It was the breakout movie, actually, for
Rosario Dawson.
Rosario Dawson and what's her name? The woman that was in every single Chloe Sevigny. That's it. And it was Harmony Korine's breakout as well. He wrote it.
Okay.
I mean, that. I guess if you have it, I'll borrow it. I haven't seen that one either, so.
I've seen it back. I think I rented it on Netflix back when I still got discs in the mail, but I don't think I have a copy of that.
Man, I guess eventually one day we'll have to talk about how Disney's creating its own streaming service and ruining the world.
Yeah.
I'm kind of bummed about that.
Or to that new Disney Netflix.
If it means some of that shit's coming out of the vault, I guess that's okay, but.
Yeah.
If it does, but there's no guarantee that that'll happen. Like, I would love to see Song of the South again.
No.
But I don't see that ever happening.
Yeah, and I mean, like, even things that aren't even that old. Like, for example, right now on Netflix is Fantasia 2000, updated in 4K and surround sound, and it's just spectacular.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I saw it on an old rundown VHS tape, and like the colors all washed out, and so to see it restored is just, it's a beautiful thing. It really is brilliant. And to have that just go back away again is a pain. It's just awful. Like, why keep that out of people's view, right? Like,
because it's horrible.
Yeah. Same with things like the old Goofy shorts. How to play baseball. Baseball is America's sport. Like, those are brilliantly funny. The jokes transcend time. And yet they're like, we're going to hide this behind a wall so everyone forgets about it. Why?
They're still stuck on the theatrical release things, because that's what they would do forever. They would re-release films like once every decade to a huge fanfare and then stick them back in. They just never got over that.
It's that artificial limited availability.
Right, exactly.
It's straight up bullshit. It really is.
I don't see that working very well in the digital age.
No. I mean, because again, as a rule, I mean, and Disney's a big one. I mean, I don't know if we're going to get to Eldridge versus Ashcroft, which is a huge deal in the same era, but like, they own their rights forever. 99 years after Walt Disney died, they own their rights. It means that you will never, ever, ever get your hands on some of this stuff.
Copyright law.
Yeah, it's insane. Like, Steamboat Willie, which is a talkie, is still under copyright protection.
It's one of them talking pictures, you say?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I just can't even believe this bullshit.
Since we're interested in Disney's film output, let's get to their next big one after The Little Mermaid, which was Beauty and the Beast.
It's a tale as old as time.
It is indeed, and it was another one that Walt Disney himself had wanted to make back in the 40s, but he dropped it because Jean Cocteau had made his own version. What's always irked me is Disney will never say, but they stole so much of their version from Cocteau's version. The Gaston character was created by Cocteau. The idea that the furniture used to be servants, that was Cocteau. Just so much.
Well, it's funny you say that, because Cocteau's is also a masterpiece of practical effects, and it's well done, and it's one of those things that Disney did very, very well, which you didn't talk about yet, so I'm going to take you to it. But something Miramax did, and something that, you know, is import a lot of foreign films.
Yes.
And the ones that Disney didn't want you to see because they were too close, including a lot of the things like that Tarantino ripped off, for example, they intentionally did not import, even if they were massive successes.
My understanding is what they would do in some cases is buy the rights and then just not distribute them.
Exactly right. And sometimes they would even do one more, which is they would distribute them to other places. Like, they would buy Japanese films and distribute them in Europe, for example, but make sure that they never reach their international or American audience before the, now, of course, the international audience is just as important. so they can't really do it the same way. But damn it, they would if they could.
Right. Remember when Disney, they were the ones that would release all the Studio Ghibli and Miyazaki movies, and then they'd like barely put them in theaters. So what had been huge successes in Japan, like maybe made $1 million in the U.S.
Yeah, just enough so that they could get a partial nod at the Academy Awards for Best International Film.
Right.
Yeah.
So with Beauty of the Beast, it was a lot of firsts for Disney.
You weren't supposed to make us hate Disney, Daniel.
I'm just being honest about the company. I mean, that's the thing about Disney. They're so image conscious that even in your own mind, you think of them as this magical place where people just tirelessly work to bring you your childhood favorites. And it's like any other company.
Yeah, I mean, there's only so many immigrants they can grind up into the animation machine, I guess.
And then they have to go with Billy Ray Cyrus's offspring.
Well played. Okay, I'm happy now. We're good.
The ripping off of the other Beauty and the Beast, if they flat out took a character from someone else's Beauty and the Beast movie, how did they...
Well, I mean, it was a public domain story, and... So, you know, good luck proving it. Plus, in Cocteau's version, the furniture didn't talk. There was no songs, nothing like that.
Right, but you said they stole Gaston, right?
That character, that, like, manly woodsman that was in love with Belle, was originally created for Cocteau's film, but his name wasn't Gaston.
Okay, and so there was just enough difference that they could get away with it.
It's and more my personal observation than anything else.
No, it's not your. It's not. Well, I mean, yes, you're right, but it's not just yours. Like, it's a little on the nose. And if you watched it, I mean, it's black and white. It's like 1936, right?
Oh, 1946.
46, excuse me. But yeah, so it's also one of these things too, where French copyright law is not as effervescent as American. Like, it doesn't last as long. So it's much harder for someone in the Cocteau estate to say anything like that, either. You know, there's not as big French film studios. You know, it's French Five or Canal. A Studio Canal would probably own it now, but anyway.
Nerd.
I'm sure it's Criterion now, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, Criterion's got a beautiful edition out of that. So Beauty and the Beast for Disney created a lot of firsts for them. It was the first animated film they ever had a script. Usually animated films were storyboarded. Mm-hmm. And Katzenberg, after seeing the original storyboard reels that the animators were making, scrapped the film and demanded that the production team start over from scratch.
Because he wanted to be the most popular guy in the world?
I guess so, or he just thought that it was terrible.
Who wrote the music for this one? Do you have that?
Well, the thing about it is, it was one of the last things written by Howard Ashman, who had worked with Alan Menken on The Little Mermaid, and he was dying of AIDS at the time. He was another big theater writer, and so it was the last thing really that he did.
This was also Alan Menken.
Yes, I think Alan Menken worked on it. On another note, a lot of people assume that Robin Williams, who we'll get to in a minute, was the first celebrity that Disney hired to do voices, which isn't true at all. For example, Beauty and the Beast had Jerry Orbach, Angela Lansbury, and I just found this out, Kimmy Robertson as the Feather Duster, which made me laugh so hard.
That's funny.
Yep. For those who don't know, Kimmy Robertson is probably most famous as Lucy Moran from Twin Peaks. She's the receptionist who goes on just a bit too long when passing along a message.
The one with, like, the huge curly hair and the gum chewing and the...
Sheriff Truman, there's a phone call for you, and I've transferred it to the phone at your desk. Not the black phone, but the red phone, the one on the right-hand side. Yeah. There's also donuts.
Yeah, her.
Hmm. She's famous for that?
Oh,
really?
Yeah.
Although her voice does belong in cartoons.
Well, like, she was also in that one episode of the Batman animated series with the Mad Hatter in it. She was the woman that the Mad Hatter was stalking.
The one that he wanted to make Alice.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was going to say, if we remade the movie nowadays, she could have been played by Tara Strong, which is funny, because that's Harley Quinn, of course.
Yep.
Yeah.
So after the movie was completed, Eisner misjudged the film during its test screenings. He was specifically worried about the fact that kids weren't getting up, but were sitting perfectly still. To be fair to him, though, 1991 had already been a tough year for Disney. Their company earnings were off by 23%, so they needed a hit.
And that's when you hire those guys who did Enron.
Which guys? One of them's dead, the other one...
Kenneth Lay.
Yeah. I mean, or just the accountants. I mean, just make it look good on paper.
Well... To be fair, though, Beauty and the Beast did turn out to be a huge hit, and it was nominated for Best Picture at the Academy Awards that year.
Yeah. I think that was actually the first Disney movie I saw in theaters.
I think so as well, or at least I remember being a kid seeing it, but the only thing I remember is the Gaston falling at the end and screaming.
I remember the ballroom scene, because it was, I think it was one of the first times that CGI was used in an animated film.
Well, and I know it
was just gorgeous.
Great Mouse Detective had CGI or a similar program, but you're right, that was a very prominent use of it.
Yeah. And everyone was seeing that movie. So yeah, obviously.
And in Great Mouse Detective, I don't want to say it's hidden, but it's less important, right? Because it's the scene at Big Ben, and most of the characters are still hand drawn. I think it's just the background that's done in CGI, if I'm correct. But that scene in Beauty and the Beast sticks out. I believe I saw it in theaters too, but the one I remember is The Lion King, because it kept coming back out. So I think I saw it like two or three times in the theater, which is something I never, ever, ever do.
That was a problem for me with The Lion King, which we won't be discussing in this episode. It comes out a little too late, but we will be discussing in a future one. It was just everywhere, you know? Which meant I saw it so many times that eventually I kind of got tired of it.
Well, I will say, too, I like the soundtrack for It, Aladdin, and Little Mermaid now. But at the time, Aladdin and Little Mermaid were a little bit less, but Lion King was everywhere. Frankly, Frozen is the best example I can think of, where you turn on the radio, it's there. It's mm-hmm. in the car with the kids, right? Like, it's everywhere.
Yes.
Ad nauseum. Like, it's stunning, which, I mean, good for Disney, because it is a classic, and it's a well-made movie. I know it's not your favorite, but it's at least a well-put-together movie. However, I was fucking done. I'm sorry. I can't care about Elsa. She's the bad guy in her own movie. And Orloff is the most annoying character that has ever been put on screen.
Oh, that he's fucking snowman?
Yeah. He's from
Fuck
a different
that
movie.
Snowman.
The sister being betrayed, though, is pretty awesome.
Yeah, I did like the twist at the end. That was fun.
Well, they also stole Elsa's character arc from Dr. Manhattan, so, you know.
If she had a giant blue secret penis, that would have been the best. If it became The Crying Game?
Oh! It would be full circle for Disney. Oh
my God, point in their favor. Although I'm sure that fan fiction has already been drawn.
By the way, the movie that... Beauty and the Beast lost to at the Academy Awards was Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. Wow.
Tough pick. Hard year, man. Good movie. I don't know. But, I mean, like, that's kind of why. I mean, first of all, the Golden Globes is a joke, so I'm not going to make this comparison. But it's hard to compare those kinds of movies, I'd say. I know, Daniel, you and I differ on this. And I'm not even going to say that Beauty and the Beast is for kids, but... Silence of the Lamb is a movie that almost got an NC-17 rating. I have deemed that funny.
Ha ha, I say. Unfortunately, Disney was slowly gaining a reputation as being a studio that was a bit too hands-on and that people were becoming increasingly frustrated to work with. This is best exemplified by Aladdin, specifically with Robin Williams. He was very angry with how Disney handled him being in that movie.
Was he out of cocaine too often or something?
He did the movie way below his usual pay rate as a favor for them doing Good Morning Vietnam back in the 80s.
Which is a great movie.
Disney did Good Morning Vietnam?
They produced it, yes.
Oh, wow, wow. Good for them.
But as a condition for being paid so low, Williams asked that he not be included in the advertising at all. Mm. So Disney repeatedly mentioned the fact that Robin Williams was in the movie in their advertising.
Which is why he's not in the sequel.
Exactly. He does show up in the second sequel. He also wasn't in the TV series for Aladdin either. That was the voice of Homer Simpson himself, Dan
Castellaneta.
Yep.
Really? Yeah. Oh, wow. Huh.
Robin Williams did show up for the second sequel, but only because he got a much higher salary and a personal apology over the incident.
Well, one of the ways... you're calling it a second sequel. The third one in the trilogy.
Right.
It was the first direct-to-DVD or direct-to-video?
Second.
The second one. Okay.
Wait, did the second movie come out in theaters, Daniel? Do you have that in front of you?
No, it didn't, because I remember when it was released on video back in the day.
The third one was the wedding one. I think the second one was Return of Jafar, correct?
Right, right.
Yeah,
that's funny.
One of the ways Disney tried to mollify Robin Williams over the whole incident was they gave him the gift of a Picasso painting, but Williams didn't like it.
What? You take it, say thank you, and then you sell it. Or you keep it and enjoy it because it's Picasso.
Yeah. I'm just saying, that's how he reacted. Either way, it wrecked Williams' relationship with Disney. And this is after he started many Hollywood of his again. Films.
Yeah.
Or at least that's how it would run today.
Oh, my God. Well, I'm sure they found ways to dick him over. Didn't he always want to be the Riddler?
That was for, they had tried to use him... in order to get Jack Nicholson to sign on as the Joker, because it was pretty much if you don't take the role, Jack, we'll give it to Robin Williams. And Robin Williams never realized that he was being used as a ploy like that.
Oh, you used me? Oh, oh.
Can you imagine Robin Williams as the Joker in Batman?
No. He would have been a fine Riddler, but I don't think he could have done Joker.
He would be too wacky.
Yeah.
I saw this great fan trailer once for the third in the Dark Knight trilogy that had Robin Williams as Dr. Hugo Strange, which would have been interesting.
Yeah.
He is a mile a minute, like, insanity, which is fine, and it's entertaining, and it's enjoyable, but I just don't know, man. He could have been Hugo Strange, fine. He could have been... he actually would have been fine, I think, actually, in a Schumacher version. Because he's that kind of campy.
But at the same time, he can do really good acting. Like, that one thing... What was that movie where, like, his wife committed suicide or something?
What Dreams May Come.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's amazing in that. Yeah. And same thing with more kid-friendly toys. Like, he can do... the serious acting that's still kind of wacky like he does.
Good Morning Vietnam would have been a better example than Toys, because Toys is unwatchable.
Well, Awakenings was a really good movie that he was in as a more serious role.
Ooh, how can you do Awakenings and then do Patch Adams? Honestly.
I don't know.
Oh, that's a crime.
Well, it's probably that you have to do the one that pays the bills, and then you do the one that you want to do.
Yeah.
Because from what I understand, Patch Adams was a pet project of his.
Yeah. Oh, that's just tragic then.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the biggest Disney production headache at the time wasn't even an animated film, but a live-action comic book movie, Dick Tracy.
Ooh! Wow. Stay tuned, guys. We got to do that one for the podcast. That one.
I love that movie so much.
That's a something, though.
I don't think I've seen that since it came out, and it was so bad.
Oh, you take that back, John.
I didn't see that in theaters. I watched that, I think, like a babysitter came over, and we rented a movie. And I will say, it makes 300 and Sin City seem a whole lot less creative.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I just can't, man. Daniel, I think you're on your own on this one, buddy.
I mean, Madonna? Come on. Come Daniel Madonna.
And you know what? That might be the least of his problems.
Hey. There was a subtle thing about Madonna back in the 90s that I never could put my finger on, but then when I got the movie on Blu-ray with it restored into high def, I realized what was happening. And it was because Madonna was wearing a see-through dress during that dark hotel interrogation scene with nothing on underneath.
Yeah, that's funny.
It's those subtle moments.
She was doing Primal Instinct? No.
Basic Instinct?
Basic Instinct, yeah.
Basically, yes. Well, let's be honest, though. This was made in 1990. Seeing Madonna in revealing clothing was like seeing a cloud in the sky back then.
Yes, but not for someone at your age.
Yeah.
It's not like you had like the book Sex on your bookshelf or whatever that photo book was called.
You don't know me.
I guess I don't, Daniel. You're right.
The biggest problem, though, wasn't with Madonna, but rather with Warren Beatty, who was another really, really, really famous perfectionist. The production was chaotic. Stars were getting fired, like Sean Young was originally supposed to be in it, but she got fired. There was union trouble over who was going to get credit for writing the script. And Disney overspent when it came to marketing it, close to $55 million.
Jesus Christ. Now, it was a movie in development hell as well, right? Yeah. Because they've been trying to make this movie since Dick Tracy mattered on the comics page.
Yes, and if I recall correctly, John Landis was going to direct the movie at one point. But to be fair to Warren Beatty, he was game throughout. The normally very notoriously press-shy Beatty gave a ton of interviews to promote Dick Tracy.
Well, I mean, frankly, if I recall, too, credit to him, because there were times when the production was going to fall apart, and he was the only one fighting within the movie to get it finished. Didn't they also lose a director? Maybe I'm making that up.
I know after Warren Beatty came aboard, it's pretty much a you surrender control to him sort of thing. So, plus, I mean, Eisner, I think, had worked with him to make Reds back in the early 80s.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Good pull, Daniel. Well done.
So, it made money, but it wasn't a big enough hit to have been considered a worthwhile investment, and Katzenberg realized that he was only enjoying overseeing Disney's animated productions.
Hold on. Wasn't Dick Tracy the first appearance of the iWatch?
I believe it was.
Well, yeah. That was from the comics, though, from way back in the day, so...
But it had to work, Daniel. You can't just put something in the movie that's fake.
Yeah, I can't believe
use Dick Tracy. Why don't we have hoverboards yet, then?
We do, but they explode and kill people, so it's a plus for everyone.
It's just the government hiding it.
Catch him in bed with a hoverboard. That's all I got.
You can keep going.
So Disney at the time was also well known for paying less than other studios, which means that they had to make the results so the top executives could get their bonuses. But eventually Eisner, by 1992, was making $197 million per year.
That's okay, I guess.
Yeah.
Not bad.
Not bad.
But did he afford that haircut?
But Eisner was about to face his biggest failure to date with his time at Disney. And it wasn't even one of the movies. It was the construction of Euro Disney.
Right.
Oh, the fact we're still talking about Euro Disney shows just how much of a failure that was.
Well, it was. Oh, yeah.
I mean, and spoiler alert, if I recall correctly, they have to sell it. Like, Disney doesn't fully own Euro Disney anymore. Which is funny.
Well, it's like anything else Disney related. They just kind of gave away the rights to it.
Does anybody remember that, and you probably would remember this better, Nick, the Itchy and Scratchy Land episode of The Simpsons where they show Itchy and Scratchy Land Europe?
Yeah. And it becomes Westworld.
Well, no. Well, the one in America does. The one in Europe, no one's at, so it doesn't matter. Like, that's the joke at the end. Like, they're like, I can only imagine what's happening at Euro Itchy and Scratchy Land. And there's just one guy who's manning a ticket booth, and he goes, "Hello? Where are you? My children need wine. Come on. It's not that bad. What am I saying? It's terrible." And then it just cuts to black. I watched a lot of Simpsons.
Oh, that's just because you grew up in the 90s, Nick.
I know. Cowabunga, dude.
By the time Euro Disney opened, it was hundreds of millions of dollars over budget, and they were 9 months behind schedule. This meant that they had to pay the crew premium to get it finished on time, which just added to the expense. Eisner feared he may lose his job over the park failing. And on opening day, it was in April 1992, only 20,000 people showed up.
Only 20,000. How many did they expect?
Well, I mean, doesn't the Magic Kingdom pull in like 60 or 70,000 on a normal day?
Something like that. Plus, I mean, again, parks back in the 60s and 70s, park attendance is what was keeping Disney alive.
That's so funny.
Thanks, Brent.
Nick, I'm sure you can speak to this. People in Europe love all things Disney.
Well, I mean, it's not only that. It's just, it's such a weird concept because, like, I mean, I'm going to name drop a bunch of comics that people don't care about, but, like, there is a Smurfs Land, which you guys might know, but, like, Asterix and Obelix has a place as well, but all of them were built in the last 10 years. Like, Euro Disney was still a relatively new kind of idea. The other thing, which I'm actually kind of curious about this, but I'm sure it's research you didn't think to do, because why would you? Disneyland, for the longest time, didn't have alcohol, and if they tried to bring that to Europe, that's a no-go. Like, that's just ridiculous that you can't have, like, a little cafe and a glass of wine for no reason.
No, that was part of the things that caused Euro Disney's failure. They refused to serve beer and wine in France.
Silly Americans.
It's just, but it's silly because, like, now, of course, they serve it everywhere. Why not? But it's just, it's such a simple thing that someone was like, oh, the French can be fine without alcohol. Like, but they could be, but who, what, why would you? Like, why bother? Life is better with booze, said my cardiologist once.
So Euro Disney was Eisner's first real failure. He started openly speculating in interviews about closing the park, and it was starting to affect Disney's bottom line and its relationship with its creditors. Another issue that was happening at the time was with Katzenberg. He wasn't receiving his contractual bonus payments. The accountants at Disney, though, were very, how you say, conservative.
That's funny.
And so he was openly threatening to leave.
Well,
and
this is a problem that we're still dealing with, aren't we? The Spinal Tap guys are suing.
Yeah, Harry Shearer is suing.
Oh, no, Disney is not the only studio to do that, where something will make a huge amount of money and still be declared a box office failure. In fact, I think the Lord of the Rings trilogy, by New Line's accounting standards, lost money.
Yeah, which is inconceivable. Like, if you lost money, why on earth do you make a further three, potentially 10 films?
Well, what it is in their books, they'll, like, say, oh, well, we had to spend this fee to this organization and this fee to that organization and this fee to that organization. The problem is those organizations are all under the studio's umbrella anyway. Exactly. So it's just money that's going back to them anyway.
Like I said, it's Enron accounting.
Well, and I think the first one was Forrest Gump, which is like a perfect example because the script writer was supposed to get a bonus if it made whatever. But they claimed that Forrest Gump never turned a profit. And it was a big movie, of course, but it was a relatively small budgeted movie considering how much money it brought back in. And it won all those Academy Awards, and then it made even more money because it went back into theaters. And they're like, yeah, no, it lost money. And he sued it for a pile of money.
Did it actually go to court, or did they settle? Do you know?
I'm sure they settled. And they bought the second script, even though the sequel to Forrest Gump is literally just insulting movie companies the entire time, if I recall correctly.
Good. But that's one of the reasons Harry Shearer is proceeding with the Spinal Tap. I'm sure he's been offered to settle. And he's saying, no, we're going to court because this needs to be fixed.
And if I recall correctly, even Rob Reiner's on his side.
Mm-hmm.
Directed the movie. All the cast for Spinal Tap, cast and crew for Spinal Tap. Because, like, they were saying it hasn't turned any profit. Merchandising made all of $24 in the past 30 years. Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, the Spinal Tap movie was a huge bomb when it came out. It was also a very low budget movie, and they've had like a ton of merchandising and T-shirt sales since then.
Yeah.
So in the midst of all of the problems that Eisner was having with Euro Disney and with Katzenberg, the biggest thing that signaled the end of Disney's good times happened. Frank Wells, who had helped save the company back in the 80s and who was the chief operating officer, went on a skiing trip to Thorpe Creek Canyon. During bad weather, Wells took off in a helicopter with three other people, and the helicopter crashed after the engine failed. Only one person survived the crash, and that person was not Frank Wells. So Disney had officially lost its president and chief operating officer, and Eisner's biggest partner in the company. So in the midst of all that, Disney was once again at a crossroads we will address in the next episode.
No, we must know. What happened?
Well, he sold his soul to learn to play the guitar real good down by the crossroads. That was the end of the joke. I have nothing else. I mean, well, I could hambone for a bit.
Well, I could tell you what happens next, John.
All right, go ahead.
Well, I'm going to need a payment in order to do that.
Right. You're taking too much of Disney to heart. The next episode will be released in 10 years for a Criterion Collection.
All right. Well, thanks very much for tuning in, and I hope you join us next time. I've been Daniel. Check me out also on Myopia and on Popdos, and we also had joining us.
Hi, this was Nick. I riff with a group in Atlanta called Cineprov, so if you're local, come see us. But otherwise, tune in with Myopia Defend Your Childhood, where every week we do a movie or a TV show that puts your past on trial.
And I'm John, and I'm a host of Mission Briefing, the podcast about all things James Bond. Catch us on iTunes or wherever you find your podcasts. And back to you, Daniel.
Well, thank you all very much.